February 28, 1983, St. Louis, Missouri. The body of an African-American girl is found in the basement of an abandoned apartment building. She is believed to be between 8 to 11 years old and has her hands tied behind her back, and it turns out she was sexually assaulted and strangled to death before she was beheaded. Since the victim's head is never recovered and she cannot be identified, she becomes known as the St. Louis Jane Doe. Over the years, investigators explore a number of different leads, but they are unable to figure out the girl's identity or who was responsible for killing her. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today we're going to be covering the unsolved 1983 murder of a young girl who has never been identified, the St. Louis Jane Doe. Ever since the inception of this podcast, this has probably been one of my most highly requested cold cases involving an unidentified decedent, which I have yet to cover. Out of the thousands of cases out there involving John or Jane Doe's, this might be one of the most horrifying because of the circumstances of how the victim was murdered. The victim was an African-American girl estimated to be between 8 and 11 years old, who was discovered inside the dark basement of a vacant apartment building. Not only was the victim sexually assaulted and strangled to death, but the killer went to the trouble of decapitating and disposing of her head. As a result, there has never been a facial reconstruction or composite sketch created for this girl in order to showcase what she might have looked like. Even though the story has gotten extensive publicity over the years, no one has ever come forward to claim or identify the St. Louis Jane Doe, which has led to speculation that her killer may have been a parent or a caregiver. So I decided that now would be a good time to cover the case, not only because we're nearing the 40th anniversary of the crime, but because of the recent release of a documentary titled Our Precious Hope Revisited, St. Louis's Little Jane Doe. Directed by Edrar Bird Sosa, the film is currently available for streaming, and not only did it reveal new details about the case which I did not know before, but it has offered some clarification on misinformation which has been spread over the years. The documentary did confirm that an active effort is underway to identify this victim via DNA profiling and genetic genealogy, but it looks like it's going to be a challenging task. Also, I should mention that the St. Louis Jane Doe has been referred to by a number of different names over the years, including Little Jane Doe, Hope, and Precious Hope, and for the purpose of humanizing the victim, I'm mostly going to be referring to her as Hope throughout this episode. Anyway, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the murder of the St. Louis Jane Doe. Our story begins in St. Louis, Missouri in 1983. At around noon on February the 28th, two young men in their late teens broke into a boarded-up, three-story Victorian apartment building located at 5635 Clemens Avenue, which had been vacant for just under 5 years. When they went into a dark furnace room in the basement and lit up a cigarette, the illumination from their lighter caused them to notice the body of a young African-American girl on the floor. Now, the official story which has been spread over the years is that these two teens broke into the building in order to search for a metal pipe to fix their broken-down car. But according to the aforementioned Our Precious Hope Revisited documentary, this account is probably inaccurate, as neither of these teens owned a car, and they may have actually been looking for copper or scrap metal. One part of the story which often doesn't get shared is that these two teens live nearby in the same neighborhood, and a barbecue was being held at one of the residents that day with friends and family. The teens did not immediately report their discovery to police, and actually went back to the barbecue and told some other kids there about what they found. This prompted the kids to head to the building and take a closer look at the girl's body, and that's when they discovered that she was missing her head. Even though some of these kids didn't want to get involved, at least one of them felt compelled to contact the St. Louis Metropolitan Police Department, aka the SLMPD. When the authorities arrived at the scene, they discovered that the victim was lying on her stomach with her hands bound behind her back with a red and white nylon rope. She was nude from the waist down, and the only item of clothing she was wearing was a yellow, long-sleeved V-neck sweater, which appeared to be newly purchased. The sweater had blood on it, and the tag had also been removed. Since the area was rampant with drugs and prostitution at that time, the police were initially under the impression that the victim might be an adult sex worker. But when they turned the body over and noticed that she did not have developed breasts, they realized that she was a prepubescent girl. It was believed that she was between 8 to 11 years old, and even though her head was missing, the initial estimates of her height were between 4'10" and 5'4". The autopsy would reveal that the victim had been sexually assaulted, and her exact cause of death was strangulation. Her head had been removed with a large blade, possibly a serrated knife, and green paint was found on the cut marks on her neck. It was suspected that the killer had decapitated the girl at another location before placing her body in the basement, as there was very little blood found at the scene. In fact, there were little streaks of blood on the wall, which were likely left there when the perpetrator brushed the body against it while walking through the basement. Even though the police performed an extensive search for the girl's head, which included checking through the local sewer system, it was never recovered. When the Missouri Botanical Garden performed mold tests on the girl's abdomen and neck and thigh, they estimated that she was killed approximately 4 to 5 days before she was discovered. In spite of the brutal nature of her murder, there were no distinct marks or deformities on her body to indicate that she had suffered long-term abuse, and she also had 2 coats of crimson-red nail polish on each of her fingers. A pubic hair belonging to a Caucasian male was found on the victim's right thigh, but it turned out that it did not contain enough useful DNA to have evidentiary value. Investigators have theorized that the hair may not have actually belonged to the killer, but rather one of the police officers at the scene, and it wound up on the girl's body via cross-contamination. Even though I've pointed out some inconsistencies in the official story about the discovery of the body, the two teens who found the girl were extensively questioned and investigated by the authorities, and were never considered to be suspects in her murder. At the time, the SLMPD's homicide unit was led by Captain Leroy Atkins, who was the first African-American head of that unit in the history of the city, so he took a special interest in identifying the girl and solving the case. Even though the crime garnered extensive publicity, no one ever came forward to claim or identify the girl. Over the course of the next several months, ads about her were run in every African-American newspaper and magazine in the country, such as the St. Louis American, as well as Ebony and Jet magazines. Investigators checked school records for St. Louis and Missouri, but all black girls between the ages of 8 and 11 who fit the criteria of the victim could be accounted for. This led to speculation that the girl was from out of state, but even though the SLMPD corresponded with every state police agency, they did not uncover any missing persons reports for young girls who were a promising match to the Jane Doe. However, even if the victim was not from St. Louis, investigators suspected that her killer may have been familiar with the area, as the apartment building where her body was dumped was not close to any major road or thoroughfares. The building was also not easy to access, as the front entrance was boarded up, so the perpetrator would have needed to enter the basement through a door located at the back. The girl remained in the city morgue for 9 months, but on December the 2nd, a decision was made to bury her in a pauper's grave at Washington Park Cemetery, an historic African-American cemetery located in the Berkeley suburb. Since she could not be identified, the girl became known as the St. Louis Jane Doe. She would later earn the nickname Precious Hope, and even though that's likely not her real name, I'll be referring to her as Hope throughout the rest of this episode, rather than Jane Doe, the girl, or the victim. Shortly after Hope's burial, a couple who owned a local business called Schaefer's Monument Company offered to donate a small headstone for Hope's grave, but the St. Louis Medical Examiner's Office thought it might be inappropriate. When Livingston Community High School, located just over the state line in Livingston, Illinois, learned about this, they organized a letter-writing campaign to city officials, so the Medical Examiner's Office finally relented and allowed the headstone to be placed in the cemetery. It featured the date when Hope's body was found, as well as the inscription, quote, "The saddened hearts were healed knowing the pain of life is over and the beauty of the soul revealed." Well, within the next few years, a potential suspect in Hope's murder would pop up on the radar. On March 7, 1985, 19-year-old Sonetta Ford was stabbed in her chest and throat with a butcher knife inside her St. Louis basement apartment before she was strangled to death. The investigation soon led to the building's maintenance man, who went by the name Thomas Turner. The authorities did not yet realize that his real name was actually Vernon Brown, and he had previously served 4 years in prison for sexually assaulting a 12-year-old girl in Indianapolis. Brown also had an active arrest warrant in Indiana for robbery and 6 counts of child molestation, which is why he relocated to St. Louis and changed his name to Thomas Turner. While Brown denied any involvement in Sonetta Ford's murder, his wife, Kathy Moore, later told police that he confessed to the crime and revealed details which had not been released publicly, such as the fact that Sonetta had been strangled with an electrical cord from a curling iron. Even though a warrant was issued to arrest Brown for murder, the charges were soon dropped after Kathy Moore recanted her story about her husband's confession. In addition, Missouri law had a statute at that time which prevented a defendant's spouse from testifying against them in court. Unfortunately, over the course of the next year, Brown would commit habitual sexual assault on his wife's 3 sons from a previous marriage, who were aged 11, 9, and 7. On October 24, 1986, Brown was sitting on his residence front porch when he noticed a 9-year-old African-American girl named Janet Perkins walking home from school. Brown proceeded to lure Janet into his residence, and even though his 3 stepsons were home, he ordered them to lock themselves in their rooms while he took Janet down to the basement. He then proceeded to strangle Janet to death with a rope, and the 3 boys would later claim that they could hear her screaming through the vents. After Brown placed the girl's body in 2 trash bags, he placed it in a dumpster in an alley behind his house. Well, it wasn't long before Janet's body was found, and since a witness had seen her going into Brown's residence, he was immediately questioned by police. Brown soon made a full confession of the crime and was charged with first-degree murder. After going on trial in October of 1988, Brown was convicted of Janet's murder and sentenced to death. Almost immediately thereafter, he was indicted with Sonetta Ford's murder, and he would be tried, convicted, and sentenced to death for that crime as well. At one point, Brown was also charged with the murder of 9-year-old Kimberly Campbell, who was bound, sexually assaulted, beaten, and strangled to death in Indianapolis in August of 1980. But since the crime took place in a different state, and Brown was facing execution in Missouri, it was ultimately decided not to take him to trial for killing Kimberly. During his time living in St. Louis, Brown resided only a few miles away from the apartment building where Precious Hope's body was found, and given the similarities between that crime and the other murders Brown committed, he was looked at as a potential suspect. A St. Louis police detective named Tom Carroll theorized that Hope might have been the daughter of one of Brown's previous girlfriends, and she was too frightened to report the murder to police. Prior to Brown's execution, Carroll attempted to question him about Hope's murder, but Brown simply replied, quote, "I've got nothing to say to you." When Carroll told Brown that confessing to Hope's murder could bring some closure to her family, Brown said he did not care about them. On May 18, 2005, Brown was executed by a lethal injection at the age of 51. Desperate for new leads in this case, Leroy Adkins, as well as a detective who worked on the investigation named Joe Burgoon, agreed to appear on an episode of the TV show Sightings, which focused on the paranormal. The episode aired in November of 1994 and featured Adkins and Burgoon having a phone conversation with a Florida-based psychic named Noreen Rainier. Now, I've previously discussed Noreen Rainier on my episode about the unsolved disappearance of Kimberly McAndrew, and I'll talk more about her background later on, but long story short, Rainier claimed that she specialized in psychometry, where she would hold onto an item that once belonged to a missing or murdered victim and quote-unquote become that person, allowing her to have visions from the victim's point of view during the last moments of their lives. Believe it or not, Adkins and Burgoon agreed to mail two key pieces of evidence, Hope's yellow sweater and the nylon rope used to bind her, to Rainier. The sightings episode then showed her touching these items and supposedly having visions of Hope's murder. She expressed her belief that the killer was a teacher who had once been dishonorably discharged from the military, and based on Rainier's description, a composite sketch was created for him. But unfortunately, the sweater and the rope would soon go missing, and this has often been cited as one of the worst blunders ever committed in a police investigation. The makers of the Our Precious Hope Revisited documentary reached out to Noreen Rainier, and while she declined to do an interview, she maintained that she did send the items back to the SLMPD after the episode was filmed. Well, during the documentary, Sergeant Brian McGlynn, one of the homicide investigators currently working on this case, was interviewed, and he confirms that the police department did receive the items from Rainier and claims that there was even a signed postal evidence slip to prove it. But for reasons unknown, the items somehow went missing from their mailroom and have not been seen since. Anyway, the information Rainier provided during the sightings episode did not seem to be of much use, and there has been no shortage of false leads provided by psychics and amateur sleuths over the years. One of the most unusual leads was provided by a woman named Sharon Nolte, who spent 7 years and $23,000 of her own money conducting her own independent investigation into the case. Nolte came to believe that Precious Hope was a Chippewa Native American named Shannon Johnson, and that the killer was a drifter living in southern Texas, and she even went so far as to collect DNA samples from this man, as well as a woman whom she believed was related to Shannon Johnson. Well, DNA testing showed no genetic connection between the woman and Hope, so this lead was dismissed, but Nolte still insisted that she was correct. Here is a quote Nolte provided for an article about the case in the December 1st, 2004 edition of the Riverfront Times, and I almost cannot believe this is actually real. Quote, "I don't give a rat's ass about the police department. I think they stink. I told them who she was and who killed her, and they never did anything with it. I had a bag full of the killer's pubic hair. Do you know how difficult it is to collect a bag full of pubic hair?" End quote. In 2009, a decision was made to exhume Hope's body for more advanced forensic testing, but when the grave was dug up, it turned out that three different bodies were buried there, and none of them belonged to her. It seemed apparent that the headstone which had been donated for Hope was placed in the wrong spot. For the past few decades, Washington Park Cemetery had not been properly maintained, and by this point, it was pretty much in complete disarray, thanks to botched burials and sloppy record-keeping. The St. Louis Medical Examiner's Office stated that no new exhumations would be authorized for Hope unless someone could determine the exact spot she was buried. Well, in 2013, aerial images from the U.S. Geological Survey were used to determine the location of Hope's remains. This was made possible by examining old photographs which had been taken of Hope's funeral on the day she was buried, as the photos featured trees and headstones which were still in the same spot after 30 years. Once Hope's burial location was pinpointed and a body was exhumed, the medical examiner was able to determine that it belonged to her since there was decapitation at the shoulder level. New DNA samples were extracted from Hope's remains, and samples of her bones were sent to the Smithsonian Institute, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, NAMIS, and the University of North Texas for stable isotope analysis, which could possibly help determine where Hope had lived prior to her murder. Well, it seems like the different tests yielded different results, as one of them concluded that Hope may have lived in one of 10 southeastern states: Florida, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, Arkansas, Texas, Tennessee, North Carolina, or South Carolina. However, another test seemed to point towards Hope hailing from one of these Midwestern or Mid-Atlantic states, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Indiana, or West Virginia. Regardless, the one conclusion that all these tests seem to make is that Hope did not live in the St. Louis area and was unlikely to be from Missouri or Illinois. In February of 2014, after the testing was completed, Hope's remains were reinterred in a new casket with angels on the corners, and she was redressed in a pink and white checkered dress. A ceremony was held in which she was laid to rest in St. Louis's Calvary Cemetery in a section called the Garden of Innocence, where unidentified decedents are buried. In September of 2022, the aforementioned documentary, Our Precious Hope Revisited, St. Louis's Little Jane Doe, was finally released. The film's director, Edrar Bird Sosa, was living in St. Louis and 10 years old when Hope's body was found, and he vividly remembered his mother telling him to come inside because little kids' heads were being cut off. Well, near the end of the documentary, Sergeant Brian McGlynn publicly revealed for the first time that Cece Moore, a renowned genetic genealogist who works for Parabon Nanolabs, was working on this case, and he gave the filmmakers permission to interview her. Parabon has used genetic genealogy to resolve dozens of cold cases over the past few years, and Moore confirmed that when Hope's DNA was entered into the databases at GenMatch, they immediately wound up getting two promising matches. However, these matches were both born around 100 years ago and had passed away. They also happen to be descendants from former slaves, which can present a challenge for constructing family trees for African-American individuals, since records for them were often not kept during the era of slavery, making documentation about ancestral lineage difficult to find. Moore did confirm that she tracked down and spoke to the granddaughter of one of the individuals who was a match, but when this person learned that Moore was working on a law enforcement investigation involving an unidentified decedent, she told Moore never to contact her again and immediately removed her relative's DNA from the GenMatch database. Moore also spoke to the daughter of the second individual who was a DNA match, and while she initially agreed to help, the woman soon broke off all contact with Moore and ghosted her. Regardless, even though the process will be challenging, Parabon Nanolabs will still continue to work on attempting to find genetic relatives of Precious Hope in hopes of figuring out her true identity. But after nearly 40 years, the identity of the St. Louis Jane Doe, as well as the identity of her killer, continue to remain unsolved mysteries. So I guess you could say the trail went cold. So getting back to the subject of DNA profiling and genetic genealogy, I'm sure you're well aware that this process has led to the resolution of a lot of unsolved cold cases and the identification of a few hundred John and Jane Does these past few years, thanks to the work of organizations such as the DNA Doe Project, Othram Incorporated, and Parabon Nanolabs. I've constantly seen people ask when one of these organizations are going to tackle the St. Louis Jane Doe, and it was not until the release of the Our Precious Hope Revisited documentary when it was officially confirmed that yes, Cece Moore is working on this case, so we know it's in good hands. We've seen identifications made in some pretty high-profile cases involving decedents, and I'd wager that Precious Hope is currently one of the most heavily discussed ones in which the victim has not yet gotten their name back. It's really not hard to imagine why the true crime community has such an attachment to this story, because it's one of the saddest and most horrific cold cases you'll ever hear about. At one point, the FBI referred to this crime as the quote-unquote only decapitation in the nation involving someone so young. It's hard enough to imagine someone being so sadistic to behead a little girl, but the fact that this has also prevented her from being identified these past four decades makes the whole story even more tragic. There's not only a vested interest in getting this child her name back, but also finding out the identity of the evil monster who did this and ensuring they face justice if they are still alive. I've already mentioned that this has always been one of my more highly requested cases, and my main reason for finally tackling it now was the release of the documentary. But another motivating factor which compelled me to explore this case was the recent identification, of what was arguably the most famous child decedent of all time, the boy in the box. As you probably know, the boy in the box was a child who was found murdered in Philadelphia in February of 1957, and he could not be identified for over 65 years, but last month, it was publicly announced that genetic genealogy had helped identify him as Joseph Augustus Zarelli, who was 4 years old at the time of his death. At this particular point, the authorities appear to know who Joseph's biological family was, but they're still putting the pieces of the puzzle together to try and figure out the circumstances of his murder. For decades, it was theorized that Joseph was killed by a parent or a caregiver, as that seemed to be the only explanation for why he was never reported missing and no one came forward to claim him. But that doesn't necessarily mean that Joseph's biological relatives were responsible for his death. As hypothetical examples of alternate scenarios, Joseph could have been conceived during an extramarital affair or adopted out or given away following his birth, and the same type of situation could have very well happened with Precious Hope. Right from the outset, it was suspected that Hope had been murdered by a family member or caregiver rather than some random killer. It seems likely that the perpetrator went to the trouble of removing her head to prevent identification via dental records, though they obviously wouldn't have been thinking of DNA or genetic genealogy back in 1983. Of course, the key difference between this case and the boy in the box is that his photograph was circulated everywhere, whereas law enforcement didn't have that option with Hope. In the majority of cases involving deceased children who cannot be identified, facial reconstruction is used to create a composite sketch of what the victim may have looked like, but you're not going to find that on Hope's profile pages at websites such as the Doe Network or the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. Instead, all they showcase are photographs of Hope's yellow sweater, as well as the red and white nylon rope which was used to bind her. And the situation is all the more sad when you know that those items have since gone missing. In the documentary, the police did confirm that they were working with Parabon Nanolabs in hopes of using DNA phenotyping to create an image of what Hope might have looked like, but apparently they cannot guarantee that this process will create reliable composites for victims under the age of 14. I know that investigators cross-checked Hope with a number of missing children's reports involving African-American girls, and one of the most promising candidates was a 12-year-old girl named Sharon Cole, who vanished outside her family's residence in Manhattan. Not only did Sharon go missing on February the 25th, 1983, 3 days before Hope's body was found, but she was last seen wearing a gold sweater. However, if you search online, Sharon is on a list of missing children who have been ruled out as being Hope, so I'm assuming they did a DNA comparison. I know I just mentioned that the FBI once considered the decapitation of such a young victim to be unprecedented, but another crime of this nature would take place 18 years later. On April the 28th, 2001, the decapitated nude body of an African-American girl was discovered in a wooded area near a park in Kansas City, Missouri, and 3 days later, her head was found nearby, wrapped in a trash bag. Since she could not be identified, she was given the nickname Precious Doe, and of course, given the similarities between the two crimes, and the fact that they both took place in Missouri, there was speculation that there might be a connection to Precious Hope's murder. Well, 4 years later, Precious Doe was positively identified as 4-year-old Erica Green, and her mother, Michelle Johnson, and stepfather, Harrell Johnson, were subsequently charged and convicted of her murder. After severely beating Erica, Harrell used a pair of hedge clippers to sever her head from her body, and Michelle helped cover up the crime, as she removed Erica's body from the residence in a stroller to give off the impression that she was sleeping. The Johnsons were ruled out as having any involvement in Hope's murder, but the whole case demonstrated that people are capable of doing unimaginable things to their own children. It's possible that a similar situation occurred with Hope, as she may have been murdered by an abusive stepfather or her mother's boyfriend, and her mother agreed to help cover the whole thing up, which is why she was never reported missing. This is a scenario which was presented when Vernon Brown became a potential suspect, but we'll talk more about him later. A few years ago, stable isotope analysis was performed on Hope's bones in an attempt to figure out where she was from, and while no less than 17 states were listed as potential candidates, the one consistent conclusion from these tests is that she likely did not hail from St. Louis or the state of Missouri. If Hope was not from the area, this would definitely go a long way towards explaining why no one was able to figure out her identity. While we're on the topic of similar crimes, there was a promising lead on December the 26th, 1983, when hunters discovered the skull and postcranial skeleton of an African-American girl in the woods behind a rest area alongside Interstate 95 in Northampton County, North Carolina. While the victim's cause of death could not be established, she did have signs of trauma to her face to indicate possible abuse. There was initial speculation that the skull may have been Precious Hope's missing head, but this possibility was ruled out. The Northampton County Jane Doe was an entirely different victim, and to this day, she remains unidentified. While there's nothing to conclusively prove that the two cases are connected, I do find it interesting that North Carolina was listed as one of the possible states where Hope had lived. So for all we know, perhaps Hope's killer was also responsible for the death of the Northampton Jane Doe, though that's all just speculation. Even if Hope did not live in St. Louis, there is evidence to suggest that her killer was familiar with the area. The abandoned apartment building where her body was dumped does not seem to be one of those locations which you will find by pure chance. Before I watched the Our Precious Hope Revisited documentary, I was always under the impression that the entire neighborhood might have been a dilapidated area which was filled with vacant buildings, but I was surprised to learn that it was actually a pretty busy and active location with a number of residents who lived there. In other words, I'm not sure if the perpetrator would have gone there looking for a place to dispose of a body unless they already knew that the building at 5635 Clemens Avenue would be abandoned. Since the front entrance was completely boarded up, there's a good chance they were aware they could still enter the building's basement through the back entrance. Given how dark this basement was, they probably figured it would be a long time before Hope's body would be found, if it was even found at all, and it may have just been pure luck that two teens decided to break into that basement and light up a cigarette only a few days after Hope was left there. During that time period, it was not uncommon for the janitors who worked at these apartment buildings to live in the basements, but investigators apparently did explore that angle and did not find any records of former janitors from that particular building who stood out as potential suspects. So getting back to the subject of the Our Precious Hope Revisited documentary, if you're interested in watching it, the film is available for streaming on Amazon Prime. But for our Canadian listeners, I should mention that it's not on Amazon Prime up here, though you can watch it on Tubi instead. I previously mentioned that the documentary shared a lot of new details I didn't know before, and clarified some misinformation which has spread about the case over the years. For instance, we now know that the two teens who found Hope's body probably did not break into the building to search for a pipe to fix their car, since neither of them owned a vehicle. One false detail which has been shared over the years is that Hope had spina bifida occulta, which is caused when a gap forms between the vertebrae in one spinal cord. This would definitely be an important detail to help match Hope to any missing children out there, but according to the filmmakers, there is no mention of spina bifida occulta in the original autopsy report or any documentation related to this case, so they have no idea how this false rumor even got started in the first place. The filmmakers arranged for Dr. Joy Carter, an independent forensic pathology consultant, to perform an analysis of Hope's autopsy report, and she also confirmed some details. It was obviously difficult to estimate Hope's exact height since her head was missing, but she's always been listed as being between approximately 4'10" and 5'4". 5'4" seems pretty tall for a girl believed to be between 8 and 11 years old, but Dr. Carter pointed out that it wasn't clear if Hope's height was measured from her heels or her toes. Measuring from the heel is generally considered to be the most accurate method, and if it had been done this way, Hope's maximum height would have been listed as 5 feet rather than 5'4", which would have been an average height for someone her age. One detail which has been the source of some confusion was the discovery of a Caucasian male pubic hair on Hope's right thigh, as it's unclear whether it actually belonged to her killer. If you search online discussions about this case, you'll often find WTF reactions to the suggestion that the pubic hair may have belonged to a police officer, but this doesn't necessarily mean that a cop removed his pants at the crime scene. There are a number of innocent explanations for how a pubic hair could have wound up there. For example, if a police officer went to the bathroom beforehand, one of his pubic hairs could have transferred to the exterior of his pants before it subsequently fell off onto Hope's body. Another potential explanation is that the city of St. Louis apparently reused body bags back then, so it's possible that the pubic hair may have belonged to a previous occupant of the body bag used to transport Hope. Whatever the case, hairs can transfer around for a number of different reasons, and since there wasn't any usable DNA on the hair to begin with, it's not like it's ever going to be used as evidence to identify her killer. Of course, one of the most interesting portions of the documentary was getting more clarification on the circumstances of how Hope's sweater and the nylon rope used to bind her went missing. If you go on Reddit or any message boards and find threads under such titles as "What are the all-time worst mistakes in a police investigation?", the SLMPD's decision to mail these items to a psychic will frequently get mentioned. I mean, so many people are skeptical about psychics to begin with, and question the value of police using them in investigations, but the idea of mailing them key pieces of evidence while they're living in another state is pretty mind-boggling. I heard this story for years, but I have to admit that until I watched the documentary, I had no idea that the psychic in question was Noreen Rainier. Rainier has always proclaimed herself to be a quote-unquote psychic detective who has assisted with hundreds of police investigations, and Unsolved Mysteries actually produced a segment about her not too long after she appeared on the sightings episode about Precious Hope. She was also brought in to assist with the unsolved 1989 disappearance of Kimberly McAndrew, which took place in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and was covered on episode number 272 of this podcast. But if you've listened to that episode, you'll know that Rainier did not offer any information which helped the investigation, and the Royal Canadian Mounted Police were criticized over wasting time and resources on her. I've actually tracked down and watched the aforementioned sightings episode on YouTube, where Rainier has the so-called psychic visions after touching the sweater and the rope. The whole thing comes across as pretty silly, as Rainier, a middle-aged woman, starts talking like a little girl after Hope's spirit supposedly enters her body. I find it telling that even though there is a ton of information available about this case, almost none of it discusses the so-called leads that Rainier provided, such as Hope's killer being a teacher who was dishonorably discharged from the military. Based on the description Rainier provided, a composite sketch of this man was created during the sightings episode, and he appears to be an African-American male with a mustache. Yet I cannot find this composite sketch anywhere else when I search online, which gives me the impression that investigators do not consider any of Rainier's information to be viable leads. But no matter what you think of Rainier, if the documentary is accurate, then it is not her fault that the sweater and rope went missing, as the SLMPD apparently lost the items after she returned them. When the filmmakers interviewed Sergeant Brian McGlynn and asked him to provide the delivery slip, which proved that the items arrived at the police station, he seemed reluctant to do so, possibly to avoid implicating the police officer who was responsible for losing them. I mean, regardless of whether the items were lost by Rainier or the police department, the whole situation does not reflect well on them, but at least some additional context and clarification were provided to explain how something like this could have happened to begin with. Personally, if the items were returned, it would not surprise me at all if it turned out they were misfiled and are sitting in an evidence room somewhere inside the wrong box. I don't get the impression that any traces of the killer's DNA were found on the evidence, but these items went missing in 1994, and forensics have advanced so much since then, so it's possible that new DNA testing could turn up something if the sweater and the rope are ever found for testing. So one curious detail about the sweater is that it appeared to be brand new and had its tag removed. You might think that the perpetrator went to the trouble of removing the tag in order to make it more difficult to trace where it was purchased, but then why bother leaving the sweater on Hope's body to begin with, especially since she was wearing no other clothing? During the filming of the documentary, the director managed to find a sweater that was pretty much identical to the one that Hope was wearing, and confirmed that it was being sold in stores in St. Louis back in 1983. Of course, that doesn't prove the sweater was originally purchased in St. Louis, but shows it was a possibility. In spite of the brutal nature of Hope's murder, and the fact that she was sexually assaulted, she appeared to have been fairly well cared for prior to her death, and there were no signs that she was the victim of long-term abuse. So if she was murdered by a parent or a caregiver, how did things reach the point where they decided to do this to her? There is no shortage of potential theories, such as Hope being a victim of human trafficking. If she was given away or sold by her family to the person who eventually killed her, that would explain why no one has ever come forward to identify her. But a couple of deceased serial killers have also been looked at as potential suspects. One of them is Tommy Lynn Sells, who was executed in Texas in April of 2014 for the murder of a 13-year-old girl, but the authorities believe he was responsible for killing at least 22 people during his lifetime. Sells committed murders in a number of different states, and while he was never officially charged with this crime, he was suspected of being responsible for the murders of a woman named Colleen Gill and her 4-year-old daughter Tiffany, who were both beaten to death with a blunt object inside their home in St. Louis on July the 31st, 1983. While the Gill residence was only a few blocks away from the apartment building where Hope's body was found, and given the time frame, investigators looked at Sells as a potential suspect in her murder as well. He was interviewed by detectives on death row, but they were ultimately inclined to believe that he wasn't involved in Hope's death. So that now brings us to child murderer Vernon Brown, who is truly a vile individual, and it's not hard to believe he would be capable of something like this. Officially, Brown has been linked to 3 murders, 2 of whom were around Hope's age, and much like Hope, all these victims were strangled to death. When Brown was charged with murder in 1986, he was living only a few miles away from the building where Hope was discovered. But one thing which isn't entirely clear to me are Brown's whereabouts in February of 1983. We know that he moved to St. Louis and changed his name after a warrant was issued for his arrest in Indiana, but I don't know when exactly this took place. It was theorized that Hope could have been the daughter of one of Brown's girlfriends, and he frightened this woman into staying silent after he killed her. We know that Brown was living with Kathy Moore and her 3 sons when he murdered Janet Perkins, but I'm not sure if they were together in 1983. I suppose that one of the things which might make me suspect Brown is that when he was questioned about Hope's murder prior to his execution, he never actually denied it. He only replied, quote, "I've got nothing to say to you." But even when they've reached the point where they have nothing left to lose, it is par for the course for condemned murderers to be untruthful about their involvement or non-involvement in other unsolved crimes, because they still love to keep using the opportunity to toy with people. I certainly would like to believe that Brown was Hope's killer, because justice was ultimately served with him, and he is no longer around to harm anyone else. However, I should note that the Our Precious Hope Revisited documentary does not make any mention of Vernon Brown at all, which makes me wonder if investigators no longer consider him to be a promising suspect, or if he's been ruled out altogether. One reason I'm inclined to believe that Brown is not the perpetrator is because of the circumstances of how he murdered Janet Perkins. He really did not make much effort to conceal that crime at all, as he simply placed her body in 2 trash bags and tossed her into a dumpster in the alley behind his residence, so it really didn't take much for police to solve the case and make an arrest after she was found. Compare that to the circumstances of how Hope was murdered, as the killer went to the trouble of removing her head to prevent identification and carrying her body into the basement of an abandoned building. I just can't reconcile Brown going to the trouble of doing all that and then being so lazy with covering up the murder of another girl 3 years later. So unless conclusive evidence ever surfaces to link Brown to Hope's case, I am inclined to believe he was not her killer. But of course, figuring out who murdered Hope will probably depend on identifying her, so it was good to learn that C.C. Moore and Parabon Nanolabs are currently working on this. As you recall, a genetic match was found between Hope and the DNA for 2 individuals who were born around 100 years ago, and when Moore attempted to contact the granddaughter of one of these people, she refused to cooperate and pulled her relative's DNA from the GetMatch database. On the surface, this might look incredibly suspicious, as if this woman knows exactly what happened to Precious Hope and does not want their family's dark secret coming out. But that isn't necessarily the case, as you have to remember that most people out there are not true crime fanatics like us. They do not have a devout interest in cold cases and seeing how genetic genealogy is used to solve them. Just imagine that you don't follow this stuff, and then suddenly get a phone call informing you that law enforcement is hoping to use your relative's DNA to help assist them with a cold case investigation. You can understand why some people might be taken aback by that, particularly if they already have a distrust of law enforcement. So even if this woman had no knowledge at all of Precious Hope, she may have become paranoid over the idea of her relative's DNA being so accessible. For all we know, the person who was a genetic match to Hope may have been some very distant relatives who never even knew of her existence. So trying to put the pieces of the puzzle together to figure out Hope's identity might be a long and arduous process. We saw a situation like that with the El Dorado Jane Doe case, which I discussed on my special update episode a few years ago. The El Dorado Jane Doe was a murder victim who remained unidentified for 3 decades, but in January of 2019, it was announced that genetic genealogy had linked her to a second cousin who had uploaded her DNA into the GEDmatch database. However, it would be another 3 years until her true identity was determined, and while details are sketchy, one of the possible reasons it took so long to figure everything out was because she may have been conceived during an affair, and her biological father had no idea she even existed. So we may have a similar situation unfold in Hope's case, where even if her biological family is identified, it might take a while to put everything together and determine who she was and what led to her being murdered. While I'm sure it won't be easy, I do have a feeling that it will only be a matter of time until the St. Louis Jane Doe is identified. Given that nearly 40 years have passed, it's possible that the person who is responsible for murdering her is now deceased and will never face justice, but at the very least, this poor girl can finally get her name back. This is a case which has made a vivid impression on everyone who has heard about it, and while it's undeniable that the St. Louis Metropolitan Police Department made some serious mistakes during their investigation, I don't doubt that everyone who worked on this case was genuinely passionate about solving it. Some of the former detectives who have since retired or passed away said that they were always haunted by the fact that they could never close the books on this one. But like I mentioned earlier on in this episode, if Joseph Augustus Zarelli, a boy who was murdered all the way back in 1957, can be identified, there's always hope for this girl. Hell, that's why they nicknamed her Precious Hope to begin with, but it will be nice when we can start referring to her by her real name. So if you happen to have any information about the identity of the St. Louis Jane Doe or the circumstances of her murder, please contact the St. Louis Metropolitan Police Department at 314-231-1212. That's 314-231-1212. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. This past month, we released a holiday-themed bonus episode about the disappearance of 5-year-old Melissa Brannon, who once vanished from a Christmas party, and even though a suspect was charged and convicted of her abduction, he has never been charged with her murder, and she is still missing to this day. I've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, discuss an unusual case from Great Britain, the unexplained 2014 death of Alan Giel. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Gavin R. and Helen S. Thank you all so much for your support. I also just wanted to mention that The Trail Went Cold will be in attendance at 2 separate CrimeCon events that are taking place in 2023. The first one is CrimeCon UK, which is returning to London and will be held at the Tower Bridge Leonardo Royal Hotel and Spa on June the 10th and 11th. And 2 months after that, I'll be attending the regular CrimeCon event, which will be held from September the 22nd to the 24th at the World Center Marriott in Orlando, Florida. Our podcast has a specialized promo code, which can be used to get a special 10% discount on tickets, and this time around, the same code is valid for both events. So in order to purchase tickets and get a 10% discount, you can either visit crimecon.co.uk or crimecon.com and use the special promo code COLD23. That's Cold 23. Oh, and I also wanted to announce that The Trail Went Cold has signed up for this year's True Crime Podcast Festival, which is taking place from August the 25th to the 27th at the Doubletree by Hilton Hotel in Austin, Texas. For more information, please visit their website at truecrimepodcastfestival.com. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourselves a good week, and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. Oh.